Welcome, everyone, to episode 31 of The Nats GM Show, the only podcast available via the Nats GM Radio Network. I am your host, Ryan Sullivan, the chairman of NatsGM.com and the baron of all baseball podcasts. Before we are joined by this week's guest, I would like to briefly mention our sponsor, Amazon.com. If you want to help support this podcast, go to NatsGM.com, click on the Amazon link on the right side of our page, and go ahead and do your online shopping. One more quick favor, if I might. Please rate and review this podcast on iTunes, as this helps us gather additional listeners and a greater audience for the show.
This is Matt from MattsBats.com, and you're listening to the Nats GM Show.
My guest this week is New York Times best-selling author Jonah Carey. Many will know Jonah from his work at ESPN.com, Grantland, and the Wall Street Journal, amongst other places, and his book, The Extra 2%, How Wall Street Strategies Took a Major League Baseball Team from Worst to First. Now he has authored a new book titled Up, Up, and Away, The Kid, The Hawk, Rock, Vladdy, Pedro, La Grande Orange, Yuppie, The Crazy Business of Baseball, and the ill-fated but unforgettable Montreal Expos. Hope I got that right. Jonah, welcome to the Nats GM Show.
How's it going?
It's going absolutely great here in the D.C. area. I'm so thankful to have you join us. Big fan of your work, huge fan of the Extra 2%, and just really thrilled to have you on the show this week. So thank you first and foremost for joining me.
Yeah, of course. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, the first place we have to start is the new book, Up, Up, and Away. I think most everybody that's certainly listening to this podcast knows that you've been a longtime Montreal Expos fan. How did the idea and the concept for the book develop, and what was the writing process like for you?
Yeah, I mean, basically, my editor of my previous book, The Extra 2%, is an American who went to McGill and became a big Expos fan. McGill in Montreal became a big Expos fan in the late 90s during the Vladimir Guerrero era. And so, you know, we would just chat casually as I was going through the race book. And then things went along, and basically that ended and did very well. And he said, okay, time for another book. I said, oh, all right, what do you got? I said, let's do an Expos book. And I was actually reluctant at first. I just thought, oh, I don't know. You know, I'm a big diehard fan, but I'm not sure that there are very many others. And it just wasn't much going on in terms of people talking about the Expos. And this is 2011 at this point. And but he convinced me, basically said, you know, there is a dormant fan base that can be accessed, and if you tell the story in the right way, then even if you, you know, live in a city or root for a team that doesn't give a fig about the Expos, you know, if you're in, I don't know, D.C. or Chicago or Sheboygan or wherever, then there are universal stories to be told, that if it's well-reported and well-written, that people will dig it regardless. And he said, if nothing else, it'll be a passion project. You can go talk to Tim Raines and Rusty Staub and Andre Dawson and Pedro Martinez. And I said, oh, okay, all right, you convinced me. And the book came out last year and did very well, very well, actually. And what's interesting is, and continues to do well, by the way, and this latest round of publicity or whatever, the paperback edition of the book just came out last month, and it's got a new chapter at the end. But what the chapter at the end talks about, it kind of builds on what the end of the previous version of the hardback did. It's that things have changed in Montreal. I mean, gee, even just in the last 2 or 3 years, now it's to the point where people are talking about this thing. And the commissioner, Rob Manfred, coming out and saying, Montreal's a viable baseball market. And I didn't ask him that. Tyler Kepner of the New York Times asked him that. You know what I mean? So people with no particular vested interest in the Expos or baseball in Montreal are talking to the commissioner of baseball. And the commissioner of baseball is saying, yep, we're considering it. We're monitoring it. The fact that there were 96,000 fans for two exhibition games this spring and 96,000 fans for two exhibition games last spring at Olympic Stadium after no baseball, being there for decades. The fact that the corporate world has changed quite a bit in Montreal over the last several years. There's a lot more money. There's a lot more media presence. That TV deals are very lucrative, and there are media conglomerates, you know, potentially lining up to do something, you know, to get money into a project, to consider bringing maybe an expansion team over. That's exciting, and I don't think it's imminent. It's not going to happen today or tomorrow, but you know, the fact that we're having this conversation, and I could have it in polite society, in polite company, and say, oh, yeah, you know, it really is possible. It's an interesting thing. If anything, I was kind of almost more pessimistic than most people, despite the fact that I'm a big Expos fan, just because I was a realist and I said, I don't see it. But now I think you would kind of almost have to be willfully blind to say that it's at least not possible, because at this point it really is possible.
Well, we're jumping ahead on the script, but I would definitely we got to keep picking this up here. So what do you think are the strengths and weaknesses of baseball coming back to Montreal?
Yeah, I mean, on the strength side, this will give you a window into how Canada works, but basically there are two large media and kind of communications conglomerates. It's sort of like if ESPN merged with AT&T is the way that I would describe it. One is Rogers and one is Bell. Bell had hockey for years and years, and hockey rules in Canada, there's no question. Rogers just took it away. They bid, I think, $5.7 billion. They got it. They're now the new carrier for hockey. So Bell has this big, fat hole in their schedule, and they got to figure out what to do. And baseball just makes a lot of sense. For a fraction of the cost of the hockey contract, they could bring a team to Montreal, build a new stadium, and start kind of the equivalent of MLB Network in Canada with the idea that some future Montreal team would be kind of the anchor tenant. So that makes all kinds of sense. And, you know, more broadly, the fact that TV money has really exploded in the sport, I mean, we talk about the Nationals, this Masson dispute is a huge deal for the Orioles and the Nationals because it will determine just an avalanche of money. And the Dodgers were bought for $2 billion with the express purpose of getting a new TV deal and so forth. I think people are understanding the impact of TV. And so not even just media companies directly, but if you're just, a run-of-the-mill multi-millionaire or even billionaire who is Canadian and or wants to be part of a consortium of new owners, you could say, all right, I'm in for this thing, not because I have charity or because, oh, I missed the Expos, but because I can make a profit. You know, sports ownership is about as, at least for now, about as guaranteed an investment as there is. It's just an amazing upward trend in what's happened in every sport with TV money just going way up and interest going way up and market values of franchise going way up. Name your worst MLB team or your least profitable or whatever, and it's probably worth about $600 million these days. So it gives you an idea. So I think that's also the positive. The fact that there is a dormant fan base, and we saw, we got a glimpse of with these exhibition games, that's also good. But, on the negative side, of course there's water under the bridge, and the Canadian dollar is not as wonderful as it was even just a year ago. It's gone down a little bit. And you've got these endemic factors that made it difficult for baseball in Montreal in the past. So really what it comes down to is, do we feel the landscape has changed significantly, both within the game and within Montreal? I do think it has. But, even if we get to the best-case scenario and we say, all right, we got owners, Canadian dollars, not a big deal, blah, 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 our team still has to materialize somewhere. Relocation is not going to be easy because some people are, maybe they might pick on Tampa Bay, for instance. It's funny that I have this Venn diagram of star-crossed franchises with crappy stadiums. But the bottom line is that the Rays are profitable and they've made the playoffs 4 out of 7 years and they are a franchise in good stead, whereas the Expos were just, it was Chernobyl by the end. It was so bad, nobody wanted to touch it. So I dispute the notion that relocation is imminent. I don't think it is from anywhere, whether it's Tampa Bay or Oakland. I don't see that happening anytime soon. And I think the more likely scenario would be expansion. And Rob Manfred could talk about expansion, how it sounds like a good idea in theory, but in practice it's going to take probably a $1 billion expansion fee. You got to find two different markets, but even if you love Montreal, where else are you going? Are you going to Portland or Charlotte or Havana or Monterey, Mexico? Or, you got to figure all that stuff out, and that's not going to be easy, and then the owners have to sign off. So, what I say when people ask me, just point blank, okay, give me the prognosis is, I do think there's a pretty good chance we see baseball at some point, but I'm not sure we could be so optimistic as to say, oh, it's in the next 3 to 5 years or 5 to 7. It might take a decade or more before we start to get real movement on this thing.
And I talked to somebody else who lives in Montreal, and he gave me an interesting perspective that, we're experiencing here in D.C. We lost basically a generation of fans. I mean, there are not a lot of 34-year-olds like myself that are baseball fans. We grew up with no baseball here in D.C. Montreal's now starting to get into that where it's, 10, 12 years, whatever it is. You give it 5 or 7 more years. Is there a concern that you're going to lose a generation of fans in Montreal who aren't playing the sport, who aren't growing up watching it? Is that a concern for relocation purposes?
No, because the people are playing the sport. Enrollment has been going up. The fact that there's no major league team in Montreal has not made a difference whatsoever. There's been a real drive to bring more baseball to the city. The new mayor, Denis Coderre, just approved a deal, a $10 million deal to convert a whole bunch of soccer fields into baseball stadiums. The baseball parks, local amateur, little league, and what have you. So baseball Quebec, baseball Canada remains very, very vibrant. And, we see a guy like Russell Martin, Montreal native, become a star and make $82 million and become an impact player. And, Canadian players elsewhere in the game, of course, Joey Votto and Justin Morneau and so forth. So you know, good things are happening on that front. And I do think that there is interest among young people, that even though there might not be a major league team there, that if kids do grow up playing the sport, certainly you can watch the sport very easily. You could support the Jays or another team, or you could just be into baseball. I don't see that waning all that much. It seems to me that that's still in play. And then, of course, if you do get the team, then that will presumably, you know, increase in frequency. In other words, you talk about D.C. and maybe there wasn't a young generation. Okay, but as soon as the team arrives, now you're just building the generation, too. So if you are 13 when the Nationals showed up in 2014, or 25 or whatever, you had that ability to re-immerse yourself into baseball, into local baseball, too. So, yeah, I don't necessarily see that as much of a problem because people seem to remain baseball fans in that city and in the province.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's really well said. Let me transition back to the book, if I can, a little bit here. And first of all, I just want to know, was it difficult for you to write as such a known Expos fan?
No. I mean, I loved it. It was so much fun to talk to all these players. I mean, Tim Raines is my favorite player of all time. And I got to interview him, and we've become friends, and I became an advocate for him to go to the Hall of Fame. And there was a gala this past week in Montreal. It was just trippy. They put me at the head table, which was bananas. The people sitting at the head, yeah, people sitting there, here's the people sitting at the head table. Andre Scalaraga, Warren Cromartie, Vladimir Guerrero, Andre Dawson, Tim Raines, and the mayor of Montreal. I sat between Andre Dawson, a Hall of Famer, and the mayor. And the mayor said, I'm a big fan, and Andre Dawson talked to me for an hour. So,
wow.
Weird and crazy, and, right, and, you know, it, whatever, I have some semblance of a career, I guess. But 6-year-old Jonah just cannot believe any of this, just thinks that it's hilarious and so forth. So, yeah, I know all that has been fun. I think the only thing that was really debated, just from an editorial standpoint, my editor and I, was how much of myself to insert into the book, because it is the case that I'm a diehard fan, and it would be irresponsible if I didn't bring it up, you know, because I'm attempting to present a work of journalism and a work of history, but I can't ignore it entirely, so that it's, what do you do? And I think it went pretty well, actually. You know, just combining the two, where I would have these stories about, oh, I remember growing up and watching Pascual Perez or whatever. You know, I'd cite some relatively obscure expo and tell these little just vignettes of stories. But it was also just heavily reported in a rigorous work of reporting and journalism. You know, just going out and interviewing all these guys and fact-checking and you know, when it wasn't a very statsy book, but when necessary, picking up stats and so forth, I treated it, you know, with a great amount of and rigor. And so, you know, as long as one doesn't get in the way of the other, I think that's fine. And there will always be people occasionally who say, nah, I don't know about this. And I was more interested in Vladimir Guerrero than Carey, which, by the way, so am I. I think Vladimir Guerrero is inherently more interesting. But the trick is you kind of try to tell the stories. And if you are going to insert yourself, just don't get in the way too much. And it's a sprinkling, you know what I mean? There's a little bit of personal stuff. But when I put it in there, I did it for a reason. I did it because I felt that it mattered at that particular point in the book, and I really just diminished from the accomplishments and the life stories of whoever, Ellis Valentine or Steve Rogers or Gary Carter and so forth.
But I think that's a unique part of the story, is that you were such a fan and that you were writing it from that perspective. So besides Tim Raines, who you've mentioned, who was your favorite interview you did for the book?
Raines was, you know, it's funny, I love talking to Raines, but I wouldn't say that he was my favorite interview. My favorite interview was Felipe Alou. Who was the manager of the Expos for several years. That was at the point where players were just leaving left and right. And in fact, the first Expos jersey that I got, I have jerseys as a little kid, first one that I got, I was in college, and it was my girlfriend who bought it for me. She later became my wife, which you can probably imagine why. She bought me a Felipe Alou jersey. Not Moises Alou, not Larry Walker, not Marquise Grissom, not the stars of that era, but Felipe Alou, on the theory, she's a very smart lady, that you know, Felipe is going to stay and the other guys are going to go. And he became kind of this Zen figure, this Yoda-like figure around the Expos, where he seemed to do everything right. He pushed the right buttons. He got the team to succeed. And beyond that, he just was, you know, he had this wisdom about him. And I was too young, and I was never a beat writer there. So I didn't know some of the stories, but I talked to other writers, and they would weigh in, and they would say, oh, Felipe used to just hold court and tell stories about whatever, fishing and life and philosophy. And it took me a while to track him down for an interview. It wasn't an easy guy to get. But eventually I got him, and we just started talking about things like spirituality and religion. And I got to tell you, I'm really not a religious guy or anything like that. And I can't say that I have deep moments of meditation or thoughts about the existential nature of the universe. And, you know, I'm a pretty pragmatic and straightforward guy. Not that there's anything wrong with that approach, but it's just not my thing. But when Felipe said it, when we had these conversations, it really resonated. You know, even talking about things like family, just talking about how he was so proud of the fact that he and his brothers, you know, his three brothers were all three good outfielders in Major League Baseball back in the day, and that them, and then, you know, of course, Moises Alou, his son, and Mel Rojas, his nephew, and all these other guys had come through, and they had established the Alou name. Now it was known. You could go to another country, and people would say, oh, you're Alou. You must be so-and-so. He took a lot of pride in that. Talking about those things and about, you know, what religion meant and what it meant to be spiritual when you are within the game, when you are dealing with a baseball team. I thought all that was just so fascinating. And, you know, it's one of my favorite interviews of my whole life, not just this book. And I think it will stay with me for a long time.
Wow, that's really, really interesting. What was the most interesting nugget you learned from writing the book?
Every time I write a book, I'm reminded that I should not write books.
It is a labor of love.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, and I have young kids, and you basically don't see your family for 3 years and whatever. And the victory lap is amazing. People say, oh, it's great. Love it. So I'm like, thanks. Cool. I'm sitting at the head table with Audrey Dawson. It's great. But, yeah, the process is arduous and long and whatever. You know, if you're going to write a book, do it because you're sure you want to do it. You know, but more broadly, I would say that just there were writing lessons too. You know, my day job, of course, is with Grantland. And I think that the writing up in a way has made me better at my day job. I think that there are, no matter how many hours, you know, if you've got the Gladwell 10,000 hours, and I have so many more than 10,000 hours of writing, my God, I've been a full-time journalist for 20 years now. Even then, there's still bad habits that you have to have beaten out of you. There's still things you got to change. I was very fortunate for both books. Paul Taunton was my editor at Random House, which is the publisher. But I hired a guy as kind of the first read, as somebody who could just take a look, and is just such a diehard baseball fan and knows so much about the game and history and numbers and everything that he could point out little things even before it got to my editor. And that guy's Rob Nyer. You know, if you're any kind of baseball fan, you know Rob is. Rob and I are very good friends, and he has helped me in that way too. I mean, he's got a lot of experience as a writer, and he'll say, you know what, this is better as a turn of phrase, simplify this, do this, what have you. And so, yeah, you know, the biggest lesson is just these little things. It's how to construct a sentence and a narrative, and you've got this point you want to make right now, but you know what, it's better said 4 pages from now. Or if you're in a Grantland essay, it's better said 4 paragraphs from now. You just figure out, I guess, ways to construct words, which is, you know, if you're not a writer and you're listening to this, that might sound a little bit mundane, but at least for me, it's a big deal because you're always trying to improve. I feel like if you get into a complacent mode with any job, whatever, you could be a systems analyst or a dentist or something, if you just kind of get, if you could just doing it by rote at a certain point, then it gets boring and you're not excited about your work anymore. So to me, obviously the subject matter is the most exciting part, the fact that I'm going to, after I get off the phone with you, watch Matt Harvey versus Steven Strasburg on a Thursday morning in Denver is tremendously exciting. But even beyond that, just the act of writing has to be exciting and interesting too. And doing different things like a book definitely allows me to expand those horizons.
Yeah, that definitely resonates with me. I hope it resonates with the audience too, because I feel like he just knocked me over with a Mike Tyson punch right there. Couple guys I want to ask you about, a couple players that I think have a little bit of folklore here, certainly with the D.C. fan base. Gary Carter and Vladimir Guerrero. Unfortunately, Gary has moved on ahead at this point, but can you tell us about Gary Carter? Because I think he's, I don't know if misunderstood is the right word, but I'm not sure he's known as he should. Let me put it that way.
Well, Carter was an interesting guy, and you know, his nickname was the Kid, and he was almost called that derisively in some ways, because he was so enthusiastic that it was like crazy. You just couldn't believe that anybody was that. It almost seemed fake. And teammates, early teammates, and even later teammates, were critical of him to some extent. Another nickname that he had was Lights, as in he would run to the lights of the camera. And I think that he was very comfortable in that environment. Matt Harvey, by the way, we're talking about Matt Harvey, is certainly like that. The handles on his bat, or the knobs on his bat, say the Dark Knight on it. You know what I mean? And he's been on Jimmy Fallon before, and he likes that stuff, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, when you are a great baseball player, you can become a celebrity, but it can rub some people the wrong way. And the other thing which maybe rubs some people the wrong way is that Carter was a straight-laced guy. He just didn't get involved in vices. You know, as far as we know, he was happily married for a long time and didn't really dabble in recreational drugs. He wasn't a big drinker. He just didn't do any of that stuff. And think about the teams that he played for. First, he played for the early 80s Expos. Tim Raine, famously, infamously, still my favorite player, by the way, but he would slide into second base head first because he had a vial of cocaine in his back pocket during the game. That's true. That's not an apocryphal story. That's real. That's insane. And there are stories about all this. I mean, read the book, by all means. It's got all kinds of wild stories that are not necessarily baseball-related, but are just, you can't even believe it. Some stuff about Ellis Valentine will just blow you away. So those teams, you know, were heavily involved in coke use and partying and so forth. And then you go over to the Mets, and the 86 Mets were just bananas. I mean, they were just coke up the wazoo. Lenny Dykstra starting down the road of steroids, and just a lot of stuff on that team. Partiers, you know, hard-edged guys, arrogant guys, whatever. And his teammates on that team didn't like Terry Carter very much. They felt that, you know, for lack of a better term, it was almost like he was a team narc, that he was just, he'd go home to his wife, you know, that's what he did. And they just would not go home to their wives because it's the mid-80s and they're in New York. And when he passed away in 2012, it was very sad. You know, Mets fans were sad, Expos fans were sad. And I believe it was Mike Frances on WFAN interviewed Daryl Strawberry about Carter. And Strawberry and even more so Dwight Gooden, great young teammates with the Mets, there's a feeling that both of them were so supernaturally talented that even though they had pretty good career results, they might have been Hall of Famers if not for the fact of coke and partying and all that. So he's, you know, notorious in that respect. And Francesa asked Strawberry, you know, about Gary Carter. The interview was about Gary Carter because Carter died. And Strawberry starts crying on the air. And he says, we did him wrong. You know, we criticized him and we belittled him and we ridiculed him, because we felt that this thing couldn't be real. His enthusiasm and the idea that he was straight-laced and all that stuff, it didn't resonate with them, and they didn't like the guy. But, you know, if Strawberry could do it over again, he would want to be exactly like Gary Carter. That Gary Carter lived a fine, upstanding life and believed in what he believed in and deserves credit for that. And so it was a very emotional interview, and I think it reflected the tenor. I think that people have reevaluated the kind of guy that Carter was, that, yeah, you know, he liked fame and all that stuff, but he was genuine. And the things that he put forth on that level were very genuine, aside from the fact that he's one of the probably the five best catchers of all time.
Right, sure.
Great two-way guy, great throwing arm, power, you know, very good player. But I think as a person, people have reevaluated him. And, you know, sometimes you could say that, you know, when someone dies, people start saying nice things about them. But I'm not sure people are saying nice things about when Stalin dies. You know what I mean? I feel like the opinion changes depending on the person to some extent. But with Carter, it's not so much that the opinion changes, it's that people came to a realization of what he really was once he passed away.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. And it's funny how sometimes that changes, you know, when somebody passes, like you alluded to. So 13-year-old Ryan would have to ask you about Vladimir Guerrero. He was definitely my favorite growing up. Probably most of my, you know, peers, that was the guy. You know, it was Vlad at that time. Just from your perspective, and I'm assuming you've interviewed Vlad, just can you talk about Vladimir Guerrero a little bit?
Yeah, he's not a big chatty guy, so it's not like we chatted at length or anything like that. Most of the stuff that I did was secondhand. I talked to a bunch of people with him and against him and so forth. His English is somewhat limited, although I have to tell you, having sat at the table with him, it's very funny because, you know, at that point, you can the shield comes down a little bit, right? And you see people in a natural environment. And so Tim Raines is talking to him. They're sitting next to each other, which is trippy, by the way, that I'm sitting across from Vladimir Guerrero and Tim Raines. And they're just having these conversations. And Raines, you know, does not really speak Spanish, and so he's just talking to him in English. And Vladdy's answering him in English, and it's not too bad at all, actually. And I think that the impression that he's given off is he's just, his nickname famously was El Mudo. I think it still is, which means the mute. He has this, part of it is just a shield, and part of it is a little bit of shyness that he's just not confident in his intellect. He has a third grade education. I mean, he had to leave school, and his family was stricken in poverty. There's a great story by Dan Lebatard, who was for ESPN Magazine back in like 2002, talking about Vlad. And, you know, he had a rough life and so forth, but he speaks okay. But, you know, trying to get him on the record as an interview, and I, you know, my Spanish is okay, but not great. And his English is certainly not great. And so it would not have gone all that well. Even with a translator, you're not going to get that much depth out of him just because he is shy. But as a ball player, just tremendous. A couple of stories come to mind immediately. And by the way, again, I should say, the book is full of stories. It's just, like, I'm known as a stats guy. There are so few stats. It's just stories and stories and stories informed by interviews and research and so forth. And it's fun, man. It's just, you know, the weather's getting warmer. go sit on the patio with this thing with a beer. I mean, that's the kind of book that it is. Or take it to the beach, you know, whatever. That's the kind of book that it is. And so a couple of stories come to mind. Number one, Vladdy is in Atlanta. He's just been called up, and the Expos are down by two runs. It's 1996. The Expos are still in the race, actually. They have a chance to make the playoffs. And they're facing the Braves. I believe it's 96 or 96 or 97. And Mark Wohlers is pitching. Mark Wohlers used to throw 98 miles an hour with location. He was a tough pitcher to hit. And Vladdy comes up, and Don Sutton, the announcer for the Braves, starts ripping the move, says, "What a stupid move by Felipe Alou. The Expos need base runners here. This guy is inexperienced. You know, why are you bringing up against Mark Wohlers, the toughest closer on the planet, blah, blah, blah." Yapping, talking. As he's talking, there's a pitch thrown. It's about 4 or 5 inches off the plate, 98 miles an hour. Vlad flicks his wrist and hits it off the foul pole in right field for a home run. His first major league home run. This is as Don Sutton is talking, and even then he still won't give him credit. He still thinks it's a bad move. And you know what? As much as I think Don Sutton is a buffoon in that respect, the fact of the matter is that nobody had ever seen anything like Vladimir Guerrero. He gets compared to Roberto Clemente sometimes because they're kind of tall and angular and multi-talented. Clemente was not as much of a hacker as Vlad. Vlad is just, he's on his own. You know, I've seen him, you know, I saw him once hit a double on a ball in the dirt. It just swings to everything. The way that I describe Vladimir Guerrero, it's like if you are familiar with Saturday Night Live at all in this particular sketch, he's Bill Brasky. Bill Brasky is this made-up character that, you know, you see Will Ferrell and other people, they go, "I remember when Bill Brasky drank 87 beers and lifted a semi-truck over his head. Yeah, it's a Bill Brasky," and they just keep doing this. He was Bill Brasky. It's just like, he's not, it doesn't seem like he could be real. And my favorite story that I witnessed in person, I did not go to that Braves game, but I went to a game in Pittsburgh. We used to road trip, my buddies and I, when we were in college. And this is, 97, right around there. Maybe 98, and we go to Pittsburgh. We go to a few cities. We go to Pittsburgh. The Expos are up by two runs in the bottom of the ninth inning against the Pirates. And but Ugas Urbina, who's the closer at the time, has gotten himself into trouble. And so Jason Kendall's coming to play with two outs. Or I don't remember how many outs, but anyway, the bases are loaded and they're down by two. And Jason Kendall's a right-handed hitter and always hits the ball to the opposite field. Very, very good at that. Urbina stupidly throws a pitch outside, and Kendall flips it into right field for a base hit. Okay, so one run scores, and Vladimir Guerrero is charging the ball. So now everybody in the stadium is standing up. The Pirates fans are standing up because they anticipate that maybe they'll be able to tie the game. You know, okay, it's a single, and there's a chance to score two runs. Me and my idiot Expos fans friends are standing up because we know that Vladimir Guerrero is going to throw this guy out for a walk-off assist from right field, and it's going to be just a thing of beauty because he's just got this rocket arm. I mean, he threw well, or he hit well. Hit for power. He ran well early in his career, too. People forget that. But, man, his arm was just ridiculous. So Vlad fields the ball clean, and he's charging. He winds up. We're giddy with anticipation. He's going to throw out the runner. It's going to be beautiful. We're going to start singing, and we're going to post-game and sit down at Pittsburgh and start drinking. It's going to be great. Winds up and fires, and airmails the catcher by 15 feet. Goes over his head. One run scores. The other run scores, and the Pirates win the game. And that was Vladimir Guerrero. When his failures were spectacular. He just had this way about him that, you know, most of the time he did succeed. He really was a truly great player, but he was so different than any other guy that I can remember watching. So freewheeling, you know, when he was coming up, Felipe Alou sat his coaching staff down. I interviewed Jim Tracy about this, too. Jim Tracy was the bench coach for the Expos, and I actually interviewed him while he was the manager of the Rockies. I live here in Denver, and he was still there. And I asked him, I interviewed him about Guerrero, and he said that the one thing that Felipe Alou told the rest of the staff was, no matter what happens, it doesn't matter how many pitches on the dirt he swings at, it doesn't matter how many times he airmails a catcher, or does the stupid misses a cutoff man, whatever, leave Vladdy alone. Don't touch Vladdy. Don't try to refine his game. Don't do anything. And that's the kind of player that he was. I mean, Yasiel Puig has a little bit of that, too. Puig has learned to refine his game kind of organically. He's become better at not swinging at bad pitches and so forth. But Don Mattingly doesn't screw with Puig because he's just this unique talent and you let him go. And Vlad is like is 10 times wilder than Puig is in some ways. And that's what really resonated with me. So I get it. I get that even if you didn't, you know, you're not an Expos fan and you're living in D.C. or wherever, anywhere, you would become a fan of this guy because we have not seen a player like this guy. To this day, we haven't. Before, we didn't. And he really is one of a kind, and as an Expos fan, he was ours for a long time. He was a treat to watch, and if he goes into Cooperstown, that could be a lot of fun one day.
Yeah, I mean, he was exactly the kind of player you wanted to be when you were a kid. He did everything, go big or go home. Like you said, when he failed, it would be a monumental failure, but he did everything so well. He was so fun to watch, too. So.
Yeah.
Jonah, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about, I think it's my favorite sports book of all time, The Extra 2% that you wrote a few years ago. I don't want to keep you too long, but like I said, I just can't not ask you about the book. You spent so much time with the Tampa Bay Rays in their front office, you know, writing the book and observing it. What did you learn about, you know, kind of the workings of a front office, you know, being so close to them for so long?
I have to tell you, I appreciate you saying that because I really was not close to them. And they did not allow me much access. And I'm going to tell you something even more surprising. At the beginning of The Extra 2%, I just felt like I needed advice. I knew what kind of book I wanted to write. I felt that it needed to be kind of businessy and have some angles that went beyond, okay, so-and-so hit 285 with 12 home runs. And so I had a mutual friend who knew Michael Lewis. And I think I had emails with Lewis once, but we were not friends, or even I wouldn't even say acquaintances. But I called up Lewis because he'd written Moneyball, and he was very generous with his time. We must have talked for 20 minutes. And he said, and this is just shocking to even think about it, that he had very little access at the ballpark with the Oakland A's. Basically, what had happened was he arranged to be in the draft room, you know, during that draft when they took Swisher and all those other guys for a Vanity Fair story. The A's maybe stupidly said yes, and as a result gave away a lot of stuff. But then afterwards, they kind of wised up and said, this guy's kind of going to give away our secrets. We don't want him in there. And so they stopped credentialing him. They wouldn't even let him come to a game just without access the way that any beat writer would be allowed access, which is bananas to me. But he'd already established relationships with Chad Bradford and Scott Hatterberg, so he just, you know, went to their houses and interviewed them, and it was fine. And that was pretty great reporting. I was impressed by that he could, and great storytelling, that he had some access but not as much as you'd like, and he made it work. And whatever, I don't know that we can say that extra 2%, I'm not sure how it compares to Moneyball, you can debate that all you want. But that's what happened to me. In fact, it was even worse. I did not get into the draft room. The Rays allowed me to have 45 minutes with Matt Silverman, who was the team president, and Andrew Friedman, the general manager. I did not really interview Stu Sternberg because they kept denying me the access. I talked to Joe Madden for maybe half an hour. I get credentialed here and there just to, okay, I'm going to get something from Ben Zobrist or whatever. That's it. That's all I had. People lower in the front office were not made available to me. In fact, the first night that I went to Tampa Bay, I texted a couple of guys who I knew. James Click and Chaim Bloom. James Click and Chaim Bloom worked with me at Baseball Perspective. Chaim was an intern. James was a writer and a researcher and so forth. But both very smart guys. And they, you know, started to rise within the ranks of the Rays and had become interesting young minds. There's a whole chapter in the book, and it's called Mystery Man. It's about the people that the Rays keep under wraps. Well, right. They keep them under wraps because they don't want anybody to know about what they do and what they're, you know, the secrets that they're trying to get. And this new generation of general manager and new generation of owner, even, that treats it as intellectual property the way that you would if you're a Fortune 500 company. Tampa Bay was more like that than anybody. So I know these guys. To give you an idea of my relationship with them, James, I was in San Francisco one year doing a book event at Google headquarters for Baseball Between the Numbers, which is a book that James was involved in. Nate Silver used to work with us, all these great people. So I did that, and while I'm in San Francisco, James is living there. I said, let's go to the All-Star Game. I got an extra ticket to the All-Star Game. That's a pretty good invite, to get an extra ticket to the All-Star Game. Barry Bonds is there in San Francisco, whatever. So we went, and, you know, we had a decent relationship. We were best buddies, but we were friends. And then Chaim was in L.A. one time. He actually slept on my couch in Los Angeles, in my house. Okay. And I wouldn't say, again, we're not best friends, but we certainly know each other if he's sleeping on my couch. Fine. Fast forward to this thing, it's a couple years later. Let's go out for drinks, I say to both of them. Sure, sounds good, they say. We go and we get after it. We're having multiple beers. I remember drinking Delirium Tremens, which is a beer that
gosh.
10%. Yeah. I had a few of those. So we were definitely getting after it. And after about a couple hours, I put the recorder down on the table. I said, all right, let's chat. I said, we might be tipsy right now. Ain't no way we're going to tell you one word. If we do, we're going to get fired instantly. Nothing. We're not giving you anything. And they didn't. They weren't being mean about it. It's just like, we'll get in trouble. And so, it was not, I just was not allowed access. And by the way, I kind of don't blame the Rays. I mean, if they feel that they have something that they don't want to give away, then why give it away? They might respect my work or whatever, but that doesn't mean they feel that they're going to benefit from the book. So I had to do it another way. So I would talk to secondary sources. I still interviewed 175 people for the book. But in many cases, it was people who were involved with the process, but not directly involved. Or, you know, I got a couple people off the record, which to this day I cannot say who they are. because a couple of them still work with the Rays, and this would create a lot of problems. But, you know, things like that, I just try to find my way around the issue and report as best as I can. And you know, the way that book shapes up, a little different than Up, Up, and Away is very much a story of the team, and also about the history and politics of Quebec and Canada, by the way. This is a sports book, but also kind of a business book. There's a whole chapter about how do you market a baseball team. You've got a cruddy owner in Vince Domoli who's caused all this damage, a terrible stadium, you know, fan interest is minimal. How can you get this going? And so things like, well, the Rays sent all their ushers to Disney World to be trained there for a week so that they could learn what it means to have proper customer service. I thought that was really cool and interesting, and maybe it wasn't the same as, you know, tell me about Evan Longoria's bat swing plane or whatever, but I think that those were lessons that were, or, and stories that were worth telling, and so I did that too. So it was just me trying to find my way around the thing, knowing that the Rays were not going to talk, and trying to come up with different angles and stories. And, yeah, like you said, I mean, if they, I hope people would like the book if they read it, but what I would say first and foremost is that it's different. You're not going to get a straight story of the Tampa Bay Rays. There's stuff about politics in Illinois, which is completely relevant to the story if you read it. And there's stuff about marketing a baseball team, and there's stuff about, you know, Wall Street things, and it's just all kinds of stuff. And it was fun to stretch my legs a little bit and to not do it as a straight sports book and do it with all those other angles in play.
And final question on Extra 2% is, by the title, you say, you know, the Rays are trying to exploit, you know, about 2% to try to, you know, take advantage of the fact that they're a small market team is kind of the theory behind it. What is the percentage now? I mean, we're 5 years or so from when the book was published, a couple of years, 4 or 5 years. What percentage are they trying to attack now? You know, is it much less than that? Is it 0.2% now? I mean, what?
That's a direct quote from Stu Sternberg. And, it's, you know, what he said precisely was, because they're competing in the same division as the Yankees and the Red Sox, and they have so much less money than the Yankees and the Red Sox do, they're looking for a 2% advantage on everything. So, again, marketing the team 2% better, or being 2% better at finding hidden talent, or 2% better at analysis, or a defense, or whatever. They just have to look for these little edges. So it's more a symbolic thing than anything else. There's nothing immutable about that term. It literally is just a quote from the owner. And we thought, oh, that's kind of a decent title. Let's go with that. We kicked around some other ideas for titles, too. I think of titles. I think it was my editor who suggested that one. So, yeah, all that means is you're looking for little advantages. And of course, that never changes. I mean, that's what the Pittsburgh Pirates are trying to do. That's what the Kansas City Royals are trying to do. And all these teams might do it in different ways, but because baseball structure is such that you've got teams based in New York and Los Angeles versus teams based in Kansas City or Cleveland or Pittsburgh or Tampa Bay, you necessarily have to approach it from a different vantage point. You can't sign Max Scherzer to a $210 million free agent contract if you're the Kansas City Royals. You just can't. It's not going to happen. So you find another way. And I think that that is universal. Won't change. You know, the methodology might change. The Royals were more interested in speed and defense and relief pitching, whereas the Pirates were focused on, you know, different stuff. You know, they might have approached it different, or the Rays might approach it different. But the bottom line is, it goes back to Moneyball again. It's, you know, the art of winning an unfair game is a great subtitle for a book, because there's revenue sharing. I mean, the sport is vibrant and parity is wonderful in baseball. We see teams like the Royals competing, going to the World Series, and the Pirates, and teams like that getting better. But it is still an unbalanced field, and so when it's an unbalanced field, you have to just do better than the competition. That's the spirit of the idea of 2% or 5% or any percent.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and I guess that's still – so the 2% still holds. I guess they just need to do it a little bit better. So.
I would say that's true.
Jonah, I could talk to you all day long about, you know, basically baseball and everything else. We haven't even gotten into Washington Nationals, but I got to cut it off here, both for your time and my time. I'd love to give you a spot here for your plugs. I know you've got a book signing in D.C. I want to give you a spot for that. Obviously, where they can find your new book, Twitter, just spot for your plugs, please.
Sure. So my day job is I write for Grantland.com. If you're not familiar with Grantland, we're an offshoot of ESPN started by Bill Simmons, who's a wonderful boss, and it's sports and pop culture. We do both, and it's a lot of fun. Very long-formish, GQ-ish, a little bit smarter than the average bear stuff. We try our best to do that anyway. And so that's a lot of fun. I have a podcast at Grantland, which is going to run every Wednesday throughout the baseball season, from now through the World Series. The first episode of the podcast just aired. Well, we're talking on a Thursday. This was yesterday, so it would have been Wednesday, April 8th. I had Penny Alderson, the general manager of the New York Mets, on. I also had a comedian named Dan Van Kirk on. We talked about the new segment called My Team's a Joke, in which usually a comedian comes on who likes this particular team and explains why the team drives into distraction. Dan's a Cubs fan. You can imagine the hilarity that ensued. That was actually a lot of fun. That'll be going. We'll be doing a bunch of those during the season. So Granahan on Twitter, at Jonah Carey, J-O-N-A-H-K-E-R-I. And then the new book is called Up, Up, and Away, the story of the Montreal Expos. Like I said, lots of fun stories, lots of Vladimir Guerrero restoring the cutoff man and Tim Raines with cocaine in his pocket and so forth that you'll enjoy. And culminating, this will be the last stop on my book tour. I've been on a book tour on and off for a couple of months now, actually, because the paperback version of the book came out at the beginning of March. But anyway, this is going to be at Bus Boys and Poets, which is kind of a partner of the great bookstore Politics and Prose. I used to live in D.C., Connecticut and Van Ness for 2 years. Lovely little apartment. It was a great time in my life. And Bus Boys and Poets is related to Politics and Prose at the Tacoma Park location, which is 235 Carroll Street Northwest. Great place. You know, you can have your adult beverages and baseball talk. But the cool thing is, or the cooler thing is, I'll be there selling and signing copies of Up, Up, and Away, but I'll also be there with seven Grantland colleagues. There's going to be eight of them. And it's going to be very much a mix. So if you are listening to, I mean, I'm sure you're a baseball fan, but not just baseball talk. Our Pulitzer Prize-winning movie columnist Wesley Morris will be there. Rembert Brown, who does a whole bunch of great stuff for us. He just interviewed Obama, for goodness sake. He's great. He'll be there. Ben Lindbergh, my colleague on the baseball side, will be there. And it'll be fun. So it'll be a fun evening. That's Wednesday, April 15th at Bus Boys and Poets in Tacoma Park. And that starts at 6:30. So if you want to show up a couple minutes early and grab yourself a seat, that's great. We will do kind of a panel discussion, and then afterwards it'll be loosey-goosey. Come up and talk and have a beer, and we'll have a good time.
Well, I'm definitely planning on coming out. I hope I can buy you a beer after you're done with your signing.
Yeah, all sounds great.
Absolutely, and we'll link to it on the page when the podcast comes up. But, Jonah, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to seeing you next Wednesday in D.C., and thank you again for joining me and being so generous with your time today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And that was my discussion with Grantland.com's Jonah Carey. Like I said, he's got a book signing coming up next Wednesday. Definitely go check it out. I'll be out there. If you want the opportunity to meet Ben Lindbergh, he'll be there as well. So a former guest of the podcast as well. So can't recommend that enough, and definitely recommend his books. He's probably one of my favorite baseball writers out there currently. So we are done for episode 31. Bye for now.